Welcome to the Naked Podcaster. Get ready to hear stories of someone brave enough to bear it all. Let's get naked. Welcome to the Naked Podcaster. Today I have with me David Levin. No, that's wrong. I'm starting over. It's Daniel. I just gave you a new name.
That's okay. Because of my Judaic look, people always call me David.
Interesting. Welcome to the Naked Podcaster. Today I have Daniel Levin. DanielBruceLevin.com. How are you today?
Well, DanielBruceLevin.com is good. I have to enter you in code. I have to answer you in code.
True. I was just looking at your website the same time I was reading your name, and it's your name is your website. So you are your website.
Maybe.
Part of it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the website.
I think we're way more than like definitely is a depiction of who I am. And on Daniel, I have two websites. DanielBruceLevin.com is my more personal website. It's who I am as a person. And then I have another website called themosaiconline.com. And that talks a lot about the work that's happened as a result of the book that's hanging out over my left shoulder, sort of flying in air.
Yeah.
Like, how does that do that?
Zoom backgrounds. Man, what a delight, huh?
Oh, come on. You didn't have to blow it. I wanted the people to think it just hovered there.
Oh, you have a floating book. You're levitating your own book. That's great. Your websites, and yes, I'm glad you mentioned themosaiconline.com because that's huge. Let's jump in. Let's start there because there's a lot there. So jump in where you would like.
Let's jump in around what it was created around, which is the book, The Mosaic. I'm 65 years old. You can see I'm an old man already now. And over the course of my life, I thought I lived a very, very, very purposeful life. I thought I was doing things with intention. I mean, I walked away from running the possibility to run a $1 billion company, to hitchhike around the world and to find happiness and inner peace. I mean, what idiot in the world does that? It's only someone who has some clear idea of what his intention is does that, because who else would do that? And so I thought I'd lived a pretty intention-filled life, but it was only about 5 years ago as I was writing The Mosaic that all of the pieces of my mosaic sort of came together. All the stories, all the incidences, all the parts of my life started to come together into this totality of one beautiful mosaic, maybe beautiful, maybe not so beautiful. There were beautiful parts of it and really ugly parts of it. But they all started to make sense. And it all revolved around this one incident that happened, me as a 13-year-old kid, losing my dad, who was my hero. He was my everything. He was my role model. I was a mini-me before mini-me's were even invented. We would walk down in Atlantic City. I lived in Philadelphia at the time, and we would go to Atlantic City for the summer for a couple of weeks. And I would hold the ring finger of his finger, and I would walk. And people would stop on their bikes and just take pictures of us or look at us and laugh or point out us to other people they were talking to as they walked by or whatever would happen. And I went, Dad, why is everybody looking at us? Like, what are we, weirdos? Like, what's everybody doing? And he said to me, Danny, you and I are so similar in the way we look, in the way we walk, in the way our cadence is, in the way our movements are, that people can't believe that you're just a 3-foot version of a 6-foot version. And we would walk down, and I think people think it's just adorable. And people did, they thought it was adorable. But that's how much I was made up in my dad's image. In my mind, I wanted to be like my dad. I mean, I just respected him and loved him. And by no means does that mean he was a fabulous human being. He just was my fabulous human being. And so when he passed away, when I was 13 years old, I was lost. I had no idea how something so random like that could happen to somebody who was so innocent and naive. I was just a kid, and my hero was taken from me. And suddenly, from one moment to the next, in fact, he died making love to my mom. A great way for him to die, not a great way for my mom to have somebody die.
Yeah.
Because she then died 2 years later on exactly the same day of heartbreak, because she just wanted to be with my dad at exactly the same time. So she willed her death, the form of death that she had was, but she didn't even know cancer was just happening in those days. They didn't even know what it was. We didn't even tell her she had cancer because we thought it would freak her out too much. I mean, I was 15 at that point, so I didn't have any decisions. The adults told us what to do. But 2 years apart, same day, same time, she passed away. And so I made up stories about my dad because it was too hard for me to realize that I was living in a world where everything was random, where anything could happen at any point in time, where I could lose the most precious part of my life for no reason, apparent reason to me. So I made up a story. He had come into my room the night before he was going away on a business trip. And 3 days later, I was going away to camp. And he came in and he said, I'm going to give you a kiss goodnight. I'm going to hug you. And I'm going to tell you I love you. And I'm going to say goodbye to you because tomorrow morning, I'm leaving early in the morning. And I don't want you to have to wake up. I want you to just say goodbye to me now. And we'll take care of that. And we'll see you on Visitor's Day in camp. And I said, Dad, what are you talking about? There's no way I'm going to let you leave tomorrow without running into your arms and giving you a hug and holding you and telling you I love you. I mean, there's no way you're walking out the door. I mean, what time are you leaving? He said, Danny, I'm leaving at 4 o'clock in the morning. Just sleep. Just relax. Just enjoy it. I said, that is never going to happen. I'll see you at 4, Dad. Well, 4 o'clock came and went, and I was still sleeping. He went out the door, and I never saw him again. So what I did is I made up a story that my dad died 4 weeks later making love to my mom because I didn't wake up 4 weeks before to say goodbye to him. Because what happened in that was that I live now in a cause and effect world where I was the cause of something. It wasn't just random. But that story had no truth to it. It had zero. If you'd ask 1,000 people on the street, would he die of a heart attack because his boy didn't wake up 4 weeks before to say goodbye to him when he said goodbye to him the night before? 1,000 people would say there's no correlation to that at all. Mm-hmm. And there was no correlation to it. But in my mind, there was. And what happened is I started to write a story that I would live out the rest of my life, that I was the cause for bad things happening in people's lives. I was the reason why things didn't work because I didn't want to live in a world where bad things just happened randomly. And that infiltrated into everything that I did. When my mom passed away 2 years later, we were suddenly alone. And we lived on the East Coast. We lived in Philadelphia. And I was thought I was going to go live with my best friend's parents, and that's where I would go. And they were willing to have me. But out of nowhere, my aunt and uncle came in and said, well, we're going to take them. And my uncle was, I went from a lower middle class family where we could barely afford to live, but we had a ton of love, to my aunt and uncle's house. My uncle was a household name internationally. And he had a $1 billion company 50 years ago. So you can only imagine what that would be worth now. And he said to me, when I came there, I'm going to watch you. And I'm going to see, because in those days, crazy as it sounds now, thank God it sounds crazy now. But in those days, 50 years ago, a man didn't give his company to his daughter. He had to give it to his son. How crazy. I mean, his daughters were brilliant. They could have easily done way better than anything I could have ever imagined to do. They were brilliant. They knew his ways. They knew what to do. But it was just off the table. And so when I came in, he said, I'm going to watch you for about a month and a half, and I'm going to see if you have what it takes. A month and a half later, he said, I'm going to make you a very happy man. I'm going to start you tomorrow pushing a broom in my office. And I'm going to let you work your way from the bottom up to where you can go, and I will be watching you and mentoring you, and I will help you get past the place where you can't get past. In 15 years, you'll be sitting in the chair that I'm sitting in right now because I'm going to retire. And I will make sure that you're successful doing that. What do you think? And I said, wow, that's the most amazing offer you could ever give somebody. That's, I mean, 15-year-old kid. I said, are you kidding? That's like everything is painted. My path is painted for me. And it took you a month and a half to see if I was the person you wanted. I'm just a kid. You're a wise man. I'd like to take a year and watch you live your life and see if the life you have is the life that I want. And he said, okay, really? I said, yeah, why not? I mean, doesn't it seem to make sense that before I sign the dot on something, I should know what I'm signing up for? He said, Danny, do you realize that 99.99 until you die would have been said, can I start today with a broom? I said, just our rotten luck on that 0.0001. A year later, we had a lunch together, and it turned out that I wasn't the person to do that. I walked away excommunicated from the family, because that's what people do that have money, that their money can't influence you. They cut you out of their life. But they couldn't excommunicate me. They tried often, but they still came back many times to try and help me, because their hearts were beautifully big hearts, and they wanted the best for me. But I just couldn't do the things they wanted me to do, because what I was looking for, what I realized only in writing The Mosaic, is I was looking for that place called heaven that the adults told me was where my parents were. That place where I could love unconditionally, where I was loved unconditionally, where I was heard and seen and known by parents that didn't care what I did. They just wanted me to be happy. And they just loved me regardless of what I did. So my life has been a lot of, oh my God, look at all this. Oh my God, oh, not for me. Oh my God, look at all this. Oh my God, look at all, no, not for me. But it's allowed me to sit with some of the richest people in the world, not in their audiences and not listening to lectures, but at their dining room tables and in their homes. I played on the floor with their children. I met their parents. They were kind enough to give me counsel, and they were kind enough to ask my counsel. And I also sat on street corners with the poorest of the poor, on cardboard boxes that were torn and shattered. And they were kind enough to do the same thing, to introduce me to their family, if not their given family, their chosen family. And we sat and had dinner together on that. Sometimes it was just the loaf of bread and the cheese and the bottle of wine that I brought for them with me. And they were kind enough to give me counsel and ask my counsel. But you know something, Jen? What I saw through my beautiful juxtaposition of all the mosaic of my life was it didn't matter how much money you had or didn't have, what color your skin or what religion you practice, what border you lived behind or who you called, how you said the word mother, what language you spoke. Every single one of us wants the same thing. We want to be loved and accepted. We want to be listened to and heard. We want to be acknowledged and validated. And in the moment that I realized that I could do that, that moment changed my life and uprooted this purposeful life that I thought I was living and completely threw it on its side. Because no longer was I about teaching people or guiding people or helping people or fixing people. People didn't need that. There are enough people fixing people if everybody wants to be fixed. I don't think they do. Quite frankly, I don't think any of us are broken. But what I can do is I can hold the space for people to just be heard and loved. And what I find when I do that for people, what happens is everything they are not falls apart. It falls off of them because they no longer need to defend themselves or protect themselves. And what emerges is they see themselves sometimes for the first time themselves, just as who they actually are. And when they see who they are, they fall in love with that person because that person's exquisite. It's beautiful. And it's real and it's raw and it's very vulnerable. But they have the courage to do that now because someone's held the space for them to do that.
As a kid who lost your dad, when you made up that story and then gave yourself the title of, if you know, you're the direct result of bad things happening. That's one thing that I want to discuss. And the other thing is, how at 16 did you know you didn't want to be in your uncle's shoes? So I mean, that you can answer quickly, but the question about, you know, taking the blame and the fall for not waking up, and that's why your dad died, that had to have where, what was the impact moving forward in everything?
In everything that happened. I had a developmentally delayed daughter, so I was the reason for that, because how is it possible to have a developmentally delayed daughter? Why should my kid all of a sudden be the one that can't speak? Or so it's my fault that that happens. I was in a relationship where my wife got sick and died of the most painful cancer you could ever imagine. That was my fault. That was something I did. There were business deals that I did with people that were, we were running great businesses together, but someone got on happy, that was my fault, when most of it was not my fault. You know, the amazing thing, Jen, that I realized over time, and part of it comes from writing a story, writing a book called The Mosaic. The story, I wrote that story. I realized that if I didn't like something in it, I could change a few words or a sentence or a paragraph, and the whole story would change. Well, what it took me longer to realize was that when I rewrite the story of my life, when I rewrite the things that I put into my life, the whole story changes. The mosaic showed me our words, our thoughts become our words become our stories, and our stories become our life. And if you're not happy with any component of that, just change any component of that and the whole equation changes. So I had to change the underlying thought that I was the reason for the suffering, because it wasn't based on any reality. And yet I built villages and towns and cities and organizations and businesses on that one thought that had absolutely no reality to it. And one of the underlying thoughts of the mosaic is nothing is as it seems. He would go and he would meet when his parents passed away, and he went on this trip to find where heaven was. The people he met were not the clergymen and the women and not the holy people. He met the street worker and the homeless guy and the blind woman and the juice maker. And he wondered, why am I meeting these people? But when he listened to them tell their story, what he realized is in every single case, the person they were when they told them his story was completely different than the person he saw when he came up to them. Everything about them changed. And so he wondered, wow, if that happens over and over and over and over and over again with people that I see, I wonder if that happens in every aspect of my life. What do I actually see in this world that is the way it is rather than the way I see it? And he realized he doesn't see the world as it is. He sees the world the way he is. And mm-hmm. when he changes the way he is, the world he sees completely changes. And so nothing is as it seems. And when I realized that nothing is as it seems, I started to dissect the stories that I created. And I had said them over and over and over and over, over and over so much that I actually believed they were real, that they were facts. They weren't just stories. But when I dissected them, I said, hold it. There is no reality to the fact that my wife not waking up made my dad die 4 weeks later. That just isn't true. And when I pulled that thread out of that story, everything that it built, everything that was built upon it crumbled. And that was painful. That's hard. Because I had set up a life around that story. And I know it doesn't sound good to set up a life that you're the cause for all the suffering, but then that's why I was the Great White Knight. I could ride into the town and I could fix the town because I was the hero. I could come in and I could take away the pain because I was the one that caused it. So I could easily come and take it away. Until I lied 2 inches from my wife as she was dying the most painful death you could ever imagine of cancer. And I was holding her in my arms and I was praying for her and I was trying to be there for her, to listen to her and be there. And she was in blood curdling, screaming pain for 45 minutes, every 45 minutes. So 45 minutes on, 45 minutes off for 2.5 years, all day, all night. And I couldn't take 1 second of that pain away from her. Some great white knight. That story also disintegrated. So then when all the stories disintegrates, what's left? That's something I would like to ask your listeners to ask themselves. And believe me, if you don't have to ask that question, don't do it. The answer to that is not pleasant. If you can get away living the stories and be happy living in your stories, go for it. I couldn't any longer. And that painful reconstruction of a life and a home and a business and a career and everything that I believed in was decimated, and everything was rubble on the ground. Then I had to do what one of the characters in my book said. Mo was out walking one day, and he hadn't seen people for a long time. And suddenly on a hill at the top, he saw a town lit up as night was coming. And he was excited because that meant there were stores there and people were there and he could go and meet somebody. And he ran to get to that village and ran to get there. But by the time he got there, every store had closed except for one. And the door to that store was open, but he walked in and nobody was in the shop. And he thought, oh my, just my luck. The one store I come into, the door is open, but nobody's here. And he thought, well, I'll just walk in anyway. Maybe someone will come as they see me here. And he walked in and it was amazing because it was a mirror store. And so everything that he looked at, he couldn't tell if he was actually seeing what he was seeing or if he was seeing a reflection of a reflection off of a reflection off of a reflection, because he didn't know what every mirror was reflecting in other mirrors. So he came up really close to one mirror that he really liked, and he was stood there transfixed by its beauty. It wasn't made of glass, it was made of bronze, and the bronze was polished so beautifully and so fully that you could see your reflection. And the mirror maker must have known that this piece was special because she made a light that shined on it that made the reflection even better. And while he was so caught in that mirror and looking at it, she came up behind him and said, oh, I see you found something you like. He said, oh my God, this is the most beautiful mirror I've ever seen. And she said, what do you like about it? And he said, I don't know. I just see myself differently in this mirror. And she said, what do you see? And he started to tell of all of his stories and all of the things he said. And she said, I'm sorry, that's not what I'm asking. I'm not asking, what do you see when you look in the mirror? I'm asking, what does the mirror see when it looks at you? It doesn't know all of your stories. It just sees a reflection of you. It just sees you standing here in front of it. It has no idea of your history or your future or your present. It has no idea how you've conjugated all the things that make them up the life that you live. It is just this moment. What does it see, Mo? And Mo said, I don't know. I don't know that I can remove myself from my stories. Sit here then and be with it. Stay with it. To this day, I still don't know what the mirror sees completely. But I'm trying to learn.
What made you know at 16, a year later, that you didn't want to follow that? Not because the 99.99% would, but because of your situation and where you came from, and what was it that made you know it wasn't it for you?
What happened is I came, my uncle then invited me out to lunch a year later, exactly a year to the day. And he said, you have an answer to my question. And I, being the arrogant punk kid that I was, said, you got to ask a question before I can give you an answer. I don't know what your question is. He said, so you forgot a year ago today, you told me you were going to answer my question. I said, oh no, I didn't forget that. I'm prepared for that. What I didn't remember is today, this day, right now, 12 o'clock was 1 year exactly later. I will never forget that again. So he said, so what's the answer? I said, I actually have three questions for you. And I think those questions will determine the answer. And he said, okay, this is weird. What are the questions? I said, I remember you had a birthday party while I was here. And there were 400 people that came to the house to celebrate your birthday. And I came up to you just like a little kid with it, like a little puppy, and saying, God, it must feel so good to be you, to have 400 people who love you and care about you and come here to want to celebrate your birthday with you. What a fabulous feeling that they bring honor to you on the day that you were born. You remember what you said to me? And he said, I certainly do. Do you remember what I said to you? I said, I think so. Let me say it to you and tell me if I'm right. You told me, Danny, none of these people are my friends. If I didn't have money, none of them would be here. They're here because I have money and they want what I have. He said, that's exactly what I said. So I said to him, can you please tell me why you would like to give me that gift? Why would you like to give me the gift of not knowing if people like me for me or just like me because of what I represent and how much money I have? He said, okay, that's not what I was hoping you were going to ask. Next question. I said, I remember sitting around the dining room table with you and your daughters were starting to date. Do you remember what you said to them? He said, yes, I do. What do you think I said to them? I said, I think you told them that they should be very careful that boys wouldn't be interested in them because of who they were or what they looked like or what they felt. They would be interested in them because of their last name. Do you remember that? He said, absolutely. I would tell them the same thing today. I said, so say I had the wherewithal and the wisdom to figure out who was my friends and who wasn't, to figure out who wanted me for money and who couldn't. Why would you want to give that gift to my kids? Why would you want to have them go through life never knowing if the people that they loved and were falling in love with who actually loved them or just wanted their money? Why would you do that? He said, okay, what's your third question? I said, let's just say that I have the wherewithal in me to know who my friends are and make good friendships. And that I could work with my kids and teach my kids how to do the same thing. If I started pushing a broom and worked my way up to the top, along the way, I would see all sorts of things that you probably haven't seen anymore because you're removed from that. And if I saw things that were not working as well as they could, or things that I thought that I could improve on, would I have the green light to make changes in those situations, to make those things work better, to treat those people better, to give them more of what they needed, to hear what they felt was important to them and supply them with what they need? Do you remember what you said to me? He said, I do. What do you remember I said to you? I said, I remember you saying to me, Danny, if it ain't broken, don't fix it. Mm-hmm. He said, that's exactly what I said to you. So I said, even if I were able to work out the other two situations, do you see right now that I have no place here? This isn't mine, this is yours. And there's no room for me to give myself to this. And I know it would be easy for me to try to become you, but that would go against everything that I believe about my life. My life is different because my parents were taken from me. It's a short life that we live. I need to live my life and know who I am. So unfortunately, I can't take this position. He said, I'm sorry to hear that. I think you had done really well. I had my doubts because you don't think like normal people, but that was part of the thing that encouraged me about you. But you know, I have to cut you off right now. And I said, well, you said you would pay for my college. Is that, do you want to cut that off too? He said, no, I made you my promise. I'm a man of my word. So I left and went to college, studied psychology. And the man who was my teacher, my mentor, was the man who created organizational psychology. He started saying, let's take psychology from the couches to the boardrooms. And he said, I want you to be in this with me every step of the way. I want to create this with me, and I'm getting old. When I get old, I'll hand it over to you. This will become yours. He saw something in me too. And I looked at him. I had hair down to my waist. And I said, Lou, this doesn't seem possible. This was the 70s. I said, it look like there's anything organizational about me? But I was short-sighted. 30 years later, I was working in organizations, helping organizations see differently and find innovation, ways to innovate. But I was a young pug of a kid, arrogant, and thought I knew it all then. But it allowed me to live a different life, which I don't regret at all.
He supported you through that and supported you after your parents died, physically, emotionally, until you went physically. To college.
Physically, okay. Emotionally, they tried their best, but I was a stranger.
Yeah. You went to college, graduated. At some point, you met your wife, your first wife.
I went to college and dropped out.
Okay.
I realized that I had taken all my courses to get an undergraduate degree in psychology in 2 years. Mm-hmm. At 18, I left and put my thumb out on the road to hitchhike around the world.
Ah, I was that young. Okay. So I didn't know the order of how this went. So you left college, you dropped out, you left at 18, put your thumb out on the road. Wow, let's dive in. I thought that was later. This is fascinating. Okay. So you also at some point ended up in seminary. So that must have been after. Okay.
So as I was traveling around the world, I was en route to India. I was looking for what happened to my parents. So I was traveling around. I had a fabulous time. I would sit on street corners throughout Europe and throughout Asia and throughout all these different places. And I didn't want to have many things. So I didn't take a camera with me. So I took a little pad and some pencils. And I suck as a drawer. Let me just get that straight. I'm not a good drawer. But I would sit on street corners and I would take out my pad and I would take out my charcoal pencils. And I would start drawing what I was seeing. And suddenly people would start to come around me. And I don't know if they felt sorry for me or they were just perplexed by what this kid was doing sitting who can't draw on a street corner. But they started to come and they brought me food and they brought me wine. And we would sit down on the street corners and we would talk in a language that I didn't even understand. We would say things to each other in words that neither one of us understood. But we were completely connected. And we would laugh into the night and I would draw and I would tear the drawings off and I would give them to whoever wanted them, which nobody wanted them. They took them just to make me happy, I'm sure. And then I would go to the next town and I would do the same thing, or I would get on a train and I would draw and I would meet somebody there who would invite me to stay at their house or to take me to their village or what. It was such a beautiful occurrence of meeting people and listening to people and being with people and just learning from people. And most of those people became the characters of my mosaic in my book. I based the characters on many of the people that I met there. And en route to India, I got stopped in Israel. And I thought, I'm going to go to, it's getting cold. I didn't have warm clothes. I went to a kibbutz there and I worked on a kibbutz. And then I thought, I got to get going. I'm looking for a spiritual thing. This is nice. It's all lovey-dovey and everything. That's great. But this isn't what I'm looking for. And so I left to go to Jerusalem to sit for Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, at the Western Wall. And I was going to fast at the Western Wall. And then a few days later, I was going to go over, I was going to fly to Afghanistan, to Turkey and go overland from Turkey to India. And I was scared to do that, to be honest. But while I was sitting at the wall, some people came up to me and said, how are you going to break your fast? And I said, I have no idea. I'm not thinking about it. I'm just sitting here. And they said, why don't you come with us? And they introduced me to a place where I was not interested in it at all. I asked them, though, if they knew about this man that I had read about, who said he was a holy man. He liked people to visit him between 2 and 6 in the morning. And I thought, I got to see this guy. And they said, yeah, no, he's right down the street from where we'll take you. Come to us, break your fast, and then we'll take you. You can go over there. And I went to see him. Have you ever had your arm go pins and needles and you couldn't, it wouldn't move?
Absolutely, yep.
Somehow when I opened the door to his study, there were 6 guys in there with beards better than mine, with hats on and great, you know, that they just looked like holy men. And when I opened the door, there was like an energy field that stopped me from going through. I couldn't get there. I couldn't get anywhere. There was a chair waiting for me. And he looked at me like, why aren't you coming to the chair? But he knew darn well what was happening. He had put up an energy field. And this was before computers were even out or the internet was out. I didn't even know what was going on. But it was as if he was downloading me into him and getting a feel of who I was and what was important to me. And finally, after what seemed like an eternity, it was probably only 3 minutes or so, he said to me, won't you come in and sit down? And I lunged because all of my energy had been trying to get to that chair. And so he looked at me like, who are you? Like, what are you, why are you, you know, just walk and sit down. And we walked and sat down. I sat down in the chair And he asked me simple little questions like, who are you and where have you been? And you say, you know, how have you enjoyed Israel? And I looked at him, I said, listen, this is crazy. You know me better than anybody in my life. I've come here for a blessing to go to India. Why are you asking me these stupid little questions? And he threw me out of his office. And I said, that's no way to start a trip to India. That wasn't the blessing I was looking for. Long story already, way too long. He said to me, you can go to India. I can bless you there, but you can't see. So if you go to India, you say you see Israel, north, south, east, and west. You say you think you've seen everything here, but you don't know how to see. If you want to come back, if you want to learn how to see, come back tomorrow and I'll teach you how to see. And I said, I'm leaving the day after tomorrow. I'm leaving tomorrow to go to India. He said, that's why I threw you out of the office, because you're not flexible enough to make that change. Long story, way too long. Something happened. I was able to get my money for my ticket back, a non-refundable ticket. I went back to see him. I studied with him. Six days later, he passed away. And they sent me to another place where I learned, and I was one, and I stayed at until one day before I became ordained, and I left.
Traveling like that, first of all, how did you fund that? I know a lot of it didn't need to be, and I also know that this is in the 70s, so different world. I was born in 70, so I remember the 70s. But also, you kind of just let life happen at that point.
Yeah. You know, when you're young and innocent and nothing matters, I was just as happy with a can of baked beans to eat for dinner as I was a beautiful meal in a restaurant.
Right.
And I remember when my aunt and uncle saw how long it was taking me to get past them through America. And they wanted me to take a 1-year leave of absence from school. And so they said, we're going to buy you a ticket from Canada, from Montreal to Europe. And I said, okay, that's crazy. Why Montreal? Because I'm in Kansas City now or wherever I am. Why Montreal? They said, because it's a cheap way to buy a ticket. So get to Montreal. And I said, I'll do that as long as you realize that I may not come back in a year's time. They said, no, we just got to get you going. We just got to get you moving along. I had $400 in my pocket when I landed in England. And it was 4:30 in the morning. And I looked at the people checking people in to come to the country to stamp you in.
Yeah.
There was only one person I didn't want to see. Everybody else was pleasant. One person looked absolutely like she did not want to be there that morning. She was in stand number 4. And the man arranging where people went looked at me and said, number 4, go to number 4, please. And I went, of all the places, can I wait for it? He said, go to number 4, please, sir. I walked up and she said, Mr. Levin, what do you plan to do here in England? I said, oh, I'm just visiting. I'm planning to write a book. I think I'm going to have this beautiful book. I just want to spend time here seeing this beautiful country. She said, so you're not planning to work. Is that correct? I said, oh, absolutely not. I don't have a work visa. There's no way I would work here. She said, how much money do you have in your pocket? I said, I have $400. She said, can I see it, please? She said, you actually have $392, Mr. Levin. And I said, well, yeah, I forgot. I bought a couple of drinks on the plane just while I was coming over here. And she said, how long do you think you're going to last in the UK with $392 in your pocket? I said, well, I think I'll be here about 6 months. She said, 6 months. She said, I don't think you're going to last 6 days. I'm going to give you a 1-month visa. If you need to renew it, you can always renew it, but you're never going to make it here 1 month. I walked out of there, went downtown to downtown London, and I started walking, and I thought, I got to figure out what I'm going to do. She's right. And I saw them posting a sign up on a storefront saying, we need somebody to work, to hand out, to do, it was Scientology, believe it or not. I didn't know anything about Scientology. They said, we need somebody to hand out personality assessments, to walk through the city and give personality things to people. I thought, this is great. I'm just going to go there. I'll do that. And they're sort of a spiritual group. I didn't know anything much about them. I didn't know all the hoopla around them. I walked in and I said, so I'm here to do, I would like to do that job. I said, does it pay anything? They said, yeah, we'll pay you. And we'll also give you an apartment and we'll give you, you know, you'll be here with us. And I said, fabulous. I lived in the house that Winston Churchill lived in. We had a private tennis court. And they paid me to walk around the city handing out, handing to people these personality tests. So I got to tour London, walking around, giving out these things, and they paid me until they started the shenanigans, which said they wanted me to join. They wanted me to be part of it. And I couldn't do that. So I walked out of there, leaving, thinking, now what do I do? And another place right on the corner had put up a sign, we want a waiter. If you in our restaurant, can you wait tables? And I said, of course I can wait tables. And I walked in. I did that about 6.5 months later. I left London. I think I had $622 in my pocket then.
It's a different time. I love that freedom to be able to hitchhike. It's a very different time. You're touring Europe at this point. You're going where you want to go. It's kind of like one thing ends and whatever else presents itself. And you spent 5 years in seminary and left a day before being ordained and lived as a monk in a monastery for 10 years. I mean, not things that you'd like, where does this even come from? But you were literally presented with an option, decided it was a good option and just went with it.
Yeah, what was driving me was this belief that I was looking for this place called heaven. So I went to school, I studied psychology, I thought I would find it there, but that wasn't. Those questions weren't giving me the answers to heaven. I went to seminary, I thought I would find there. That didn't give me heaven. I started traveling around the world, meeting people. That was beautiful. Everything was fabulous. Like everything now, if I look back on it, I could do it now because I feel like I have found my heaven. And so heaven isn't about what I do. It's about how we are. And what I realized through really writing the Mosaic was that change of perspective moment where I suddenly saw these people, the common ordinary people, is completely different than the way I initially saw them. That moment where that thing switches, that perceptual shift was really my heaven. I realized when I change the way I see the world I see changes. But it took me a long time to learn that. So part of what I try and do with people now is I just hold the space to say, where are you looking at your life in a way that that you keep seeing it a certain way that's keeping you bound to the way you see your life? And what would happen if you unraveled some of those stories? What would happen if you got real and raw and naked enough with yourself? That you could actually see yourself as who you are, devoid of those stories.
Right.
Do you have the courage to do that? And if you do, and again, if you don't have to, don't. It is not a road full of rose petals. It's painful. It's painstaking. It's hard. It doesn't have to be, but for me, I hold on longer than most people. And so I held on to these beliefs that I just wanted to believe and things that I wanted to have and things that I thought were real and people that I thought were great and things that I thought were important to me. But those were all taken from me. And again, I got to sit in front of that mirror and said, what does the mirror see when it sees me? Who am I? And Jen, I have to tell you, one of my saddest memories in my life is looking at a world that has so much success, so much affluence, so much abundance, but so little sense of who they are. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was in the wealthy part of my life, not because of anything I did, but because I was with people that were wealthy. My best friend and I were dreamt of what we would do together as billionaires to change the world. And when I left my uncle's, the opportunity my uncle so generously offered, he excommunicated me too. He said, you're just a stupid idiot. Like you had the whole world set up for you and we were going to do this together. And I can't, you're going to go to find yourself? Like, what the hell are you talking about? Why would you do something so friggin' stupid? And he didn't speak to me. And it hurt me. 30 years later, I was staying in New York at a hotel called the Mandarin Oriental, a beautiful hotel right on Central Park. There's an elevator that you take from the ground floor up to the lobby. It's on the 34th floor. And then you go from the lobby, there are elevators that take you to your room. Well, it was about 10:30 at night, and I was coming home from a night out with friends that I had been with. And I was taking that elevator. I came to the lobby, and as the door opened and I was getting out, people were getting in. And I looked to my right and I couldn't believe it. I said, Neil, it was my friend from 30 years ago that I hadn't seen or who hadn't talked to me. And he said, who called my name? I said, I did. He said, well, how do you know my name? I said, you don't even recognize me, do you? He said, who are you? I said, do you remember when we were 15, you and I were best friends. We did everything together. Now it's 30 years later. He said, come with us. We're going to the club. Danny, I can't believe it's you. Come on, come with us. I said, you know, I'm not really a club guy right now, but like, let's meet for breakfast or something. And he looked at the people he was with. He said, screw this. You guys go to the club. I'm going to spend time. He said, will you have a scotch and will you smoke a cigar with me? I said, sure, let's just do that. We sat in the lobby from 10:30 at night till 4:30 in the morning, drinking scotch and having cigars and catching up on 30 years. Close to the end of that time, he looked at me and he said, you know, I hated you. You know, I couldn't believe you did what you did. I was so embarrassed and ashamed of you that you would leave this fortune to do this crazy trip that you were on. But I look at you now. You're simple and you're innocent. You have a peace to you that I wish I had, and money can't buy. I'm on my fourth wife. The women that I was in the elevator with, I come to New York to cheat with every time I'm here. My kids don't talk to me. I have more money than God, but I don't have one moment of content or happiness. And I look at you. You're a simple man. And you have everything that I want. I said, Neil, it's so easy. I'll sit with you. You're my close friend. Like, let's just sit together. I'll hold the space for you to have that all. You can have it. You know how to do this. You've got this. He said, as soon as I get back home, I'm going to call you. That was about 15 years ago. I haven't heard from him. And that hurts me because people see what they don't have. But it's just too scary to leave the dream and the story of what we created, all the stories that are still not unraveled, to actually be raw and naked and to sit naked in front of another human being and just be able to show yourself, not indecently, but decently, to be able to sit and show yourself and be vulnerable and there. And when you can do that, there is no fortune that is big enough to take you from that space. And there is no fortune you can't have if it's what you truly want.
Tell me about the shift from the story that you created at 13 when your dad died to the book and how that had to have shifted everything in your life. And then the writing of the book. And then you started podcasts. I mean,
yeah.
There's been a lot since then. Since that shift in your life, things have gone very differently. So
yeah,
let's explore.
So what I realized is the dad that I thought left me, the mosaic again is the story of is my story. It's written up in a fabulized version, and over the course of time, what happens is Mo, when he realizes that people aren't what he thinks they are, when he sees that who they are is different than he first saw. In the book, he looks over to his right and he sees a monk unzipping the sky. And the monk is looking at him, inviting him to come through the unzipped sky into a parallel reality where he meets the wise one, who's the keeper of the mosaic. And the wise one gives him an experience of the unity of the whole world. We see ourselves as all these broken pieces. You're a piece, I'm a piece, but we don't see that we're connected. In that moment, the wise one gave Mo the experience of being connected to everything. And then he took it away. Mo appeared next on the street corner next to a street artist who was making mosaics. And the street artist said to him, Mo, when you look at these pieces, people give me all these broken pieces. When you look at these pieces, what do you see? And he said, I'm afraid I just see broken pieces, because he didn't know how much he could say. He said, so you've just come from the great mosaic maker up there knowing what you know, because he knew what would happen. And he said, now you look at these pieces and that's all you can tell me? He said, no, I see a world down here that feels it's broken and shattered. And all the pieces feel that they have to be beautiful in themselves, and they don't want to connect with everybody because they think their piece is so beautiful, which prevents them from connecting to everybody else. But a mosaic is made up of beautiful pieces that come together to create something far more exquisite than any one of those pieces could ever create. We're so much capable, more capable when we go together. We all know, united we stand, divided we fall. And so he started to see that the unity in that. Well, when it comes time for him, for the book to end, and I won't ruin it for people, but he has an experience. He meets his dad again. And what he sees in his dad is something that blows his mind. Because what he realizes is his dad never left him. Just because we can't see what's right in front of us, what we see in front of us isn't real anyway. What's there? What does what we see block us from seeing? Did you ever see that beautiful picture? It's not beautiful, it's just simple, but they use it in psychology, where you look at it one way, it's a line drawing. Yeah. You look at it one way, it's an old woman, and another way, it's a young socialite. Well, when you look at it and you see the old hag, you can't see the socialite. Mm-hmm. That's the way life is for us. What we see actually blocks us from seeing everything else that's in that same picture. It's not like it's not in that picture. It's right there. We just can't see it. Yep. Well, in the world we live in, what we see blocks us from seeing everything else. And so what the mosaic brought me to the place is that nothing that I see that I thought was real is real. There's something real behind that. And I realized my dad is always here. He hasn't left me. He's always been here. I just couldn't see him. My mom hasn't left me. She's always been here. But I feel him. I speak to him. I can hear him. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think we have to do anything. But for me, when I started to realize that everything in the world is speaking to me, if I would only listen, the characters in the book that I wrote wouldn't let me finish the book the way I was writing it. I would write a fabulous chapter. I would save it at night. I would wake up in the morning. It wasn't saved. I couldn't find it anywhere on my computer. My computer would crash. I would be able to recover everything but the book that I wrote. Finally, I came to them and I said, God Almighty, and these were made up characters. These were my characters. I made them up. I said to them, what are you doing? What's happening here? Why won't you let me finish this book? And they said, Danny, what you're writing for us to say is not what we want to say. You're writing what you want us to say. I said, well, in all due respect, you're my characters. I made you up. I should be able to tell you what to say. I should have that right to give you my voice through you. They said, yes, but then you'll never learn what you have to learn. This book is for you. We're trying to write tell you what you need to hear, and what other people will hear from that will be a bonus, but we're trying to write what you need to hear and hear it. And when you write it, if you write what we're telling you to say, your book will be done in 30 days. If you write the way you're going to go, it'll be another 5 years. I said, deal. I'm going crazy with this thing. Let's get it done. Jen, the voice that comes through the mosaic has changed me. That was not me that wrote that. That voice is a softer, kinder, gentler voice. That voice is a voice that's loving and listens and beautifully wanting to see the harmony of all things. I was an arrogant little know-it-all kid. It didn't change much over time. I thought I knew everything. My daughter still thinks I know everything. You know, she says, you think you know everything. She's probably right. But the book has changed me because it was when I was at Hay House and I watched the books that people wrote, mm-hmm. they didn't write the book they knew. They wrote the book they most needed to read, mm-hmm. most of the time. The Mosaic was the book I most needed to read. And in it, I am transforming myself. And in the stories that it tells, people are feeling some sort of change. They're starting to see perspective shift. It's not like anything's fixed. It's just, you don't fix anything when you see the world different. You just see the world different.
Correct. Yeah. Let's end on a high note, although this hasn't been a low note at all. Let's end on a high note and talk about the websites. You have two, how people can connect with you or become a podcast guest or have more conversations. You have a lot of ways to connect on the website, the Mosaic online website. And then you also have your name website.
Yeah. So I would say to people, just go, and I'm sure they're going to be in the show notes, just go there if they're interested in what I've said. And I've been a little bit all over the place. I apologize for that.
That's all right. That's how I like it.
But if you go there and something draws you, do I have time to end with one more story?
Yeah.
One of the things that's super important to me is this. I want to start a revolution of listening. And when that thought came to me, I went to my creator, the voice that I listened to, and I said, "You must be really desperate. Look how much I talk. Look how much I talked on this show. I mean, can't you find anybody in the world that listens better than me? I'm the person you want to do that?" And they said, "Danny, it's for two reasons. One, it's because you need to learn how to listen better. And two, it's because you're a great storyteller. And when you tell stories, what happens is the mind of people becomes engaged. And it allows you to touch their heart and their soul with your vibration and your love without the mind getting scared of what's happening. So we want you to continue to talk because we want you to continue to occupy, like they have Occupy Wall Street, my movements occupy mind so that we can actually have create a revolution of love and listening." And that revolution of listening came down to my daughter's situation with my daughter, writing the book, and a homeless man. I'd like to tell you about a homeless man that I met on a street corner because it's a promise that I made to myself that I would try and put his message out to as many people as I could. I was walking in downtown San Diego and I came upon a corner where I saw a homeless guy by the name of Corey. And I walked up to Corey and I said, I just want to sit with you and talk and hear you. And he said, no, this is my corner. You can't talk to me. I need to make money here. I need to make a living. I need to make money. I support some people and I can't, I make $5 a half an hour and I can't have you take that away from me. I took my hand and put it in my wallet and I pulled out $50 and I said, here, let this cover the next half an hour or 45 minutes. Okay. And keep your hat out. We'll make more money too. So he said, you're weird. Okay. Just sit down. What is it you want? And it took about 35, 40 minutes for me to get through to him. And I said, Corey, you sit on this street corner and you watch people pass you by. What is it you'd like to say to them? And he said, you've told me a lot of stories, Danny. I'd like to tell you one. I said, please. He said, I hate being homeless. I'm embarrassed and ashamed of myself. But I can put up with it. But the way people treat me, sometimes I can't put up with it. They don't treat me even like an animal. They treat me as a thing. The other day, boys came by and just kicked me and beat me. Another day, people came by and stole my money. Another day, I was laying here sleeping and someone urinated on me and I woke up. Someone threw a bag of manure at me. And I thought, this is terrible. I have no life and people treat me like I'm worthless. I'm just going to go around the corner on the street behind us, Danny. It's a dead street. It's dark and silent. Nobody travels it. And I thought, I'm just going to walk over. When it gets dark, I'm going to go on that street and I'm going to take my life. 2 minutes later, a man came up to me and he put his hand on my shoulder. He was in a three-piece suit. And he said, how are you doing, brother? And I said, no, this isn't a good time. I'm not feeling good. You don't want to get involved in this. Just keep walking. Just please keep walking, sir. You're not going to be, this is not a conversation you want to have. And the man said, there's no chance I'm going to keep walking. And he sat down next to me, he put his arm around me. For some reason, maybe it was the three-piece suit, maybe it was the fact that somebody important had sat with somebody like me who was not important, who was thinking of taking his life, but I just started crying like a baby in his arms. He said, Danny, it only took about 10 minutes, but I cried my tears out, and he listened to me. He didn't try and fix me. He didn't try and help me. He didn't try and change me. He just listened to me. So what I would like to say to people who are walking past me right now, if they would listen, is take 10 minutes out of the course of your life and find someone you don't know, someone who might need an ear of somebody to listen to them, and just go up to them and ask them how you're doing. He said, I wish I could have found that man again. I wish he would have come by. Because he doesn't know he saved my life that day. I didn't kill myself because somebody important had actually thought enough about me to sit with me. Well, I went back to find Corey months later, but he wasn't there. Because what Corey doesn't know, it's called the butterfly effect. A butterfly flaps his wings and a wind comes somewhere else. What Corey doesn't realize is that every time I've spoken to people in a lecture, in a hall, in a conference, in a boardroom, in a podcast, in a radio show, in a TV, I've told the story of Corey. By now, millions of people have heard Corey's story. And millions of people have received Corey's offer. Why not take 10 minutes out of the course of your life to find someone you don't know and just ask them how they're doing? You have no idea what that might do to somebody. 10 minutes out of the course of a lifetime is not too much to ask. It's become the cornerstone of the revolution of listening that I really want to create. It costs nothing to join the revolution. It just costs 10 minutes of your time. The reason I have conversations with strangers is it's my way of showing a little window into the life of what it's like to just sit with no agenda and love and accept another human being, listen to them and hear them and acknowledge what they're saying is what they're saying. If we could just do that, I believe the world we live in would transform itself on an axis.
It's not Danny, thank you so much for being here. Thank you.
It has been an honor. I would like to have another time with you off camera where we get to talk about what you're doing and how life is for you, because you just opened up the space and I just spoke.
Yeah.
I appreciate you doing that. I really do.
Absolutely. It's my honor.
Thank you for having me. What a gift.